This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. What's the future of solar energy? Our guest in this portion of the program, Travis Bradford, says solar energy won't power everything, but he predicts it will become the best and cheapest choice for most applications and the only viable energy option for many throughout the world. Travis Bradford is the president and founder of the Prometheus Institute for Sustainable Development and the author of Solar Revolution, the economic transformation of the global energy industry. Early in the book, he says consumers will turn to the sun for their energy, not because solar power is clean and green, but because basic economic and political reasons will compel us to choose solar. And he thinks the transition will come relatively quickly, rivaling the speed with which we have embraced communication and information technologies. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Travis Bradford. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Before founding the Prometheus Institute, forgive me, for Sustainable Development, Travis Bradford was a partner in various New York-based corporate acquisition and investment funds. He earned his MBA and MPA at Harvard. The book, Solar Revolution, The Economic Transformation of the Global Energy Industry, is published by the MIT Press. And you'll find the Prometheus Institute on the web at www.prometheusinstitute.org. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Travis Bradford, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Tell us about the Institute, first of all.
Well, the Institute is developed as a nonprofit tool to help connect the power of business, capital markets, industrial processes to the concepts of sustainable development. So, and sustainable development referring to how we harness the basic resources that we need to fuel our lives, our homes, our businesses, our economies, the energy, the water, the food, the materials, and how are we going to do that sustainably? And it has to include the power of markets to efficiently allocate resources where they're needed, and to help people who are often thinking of things in their own best interest to give them options to get the resources that they need in a clean way.
Hmm. As I mentioned in my introduction, and as you write about in your book, we're going to adopt solar, not because it's clean and green, but because it makes sense economically and politically. How cost-effective is solar energy at this moment in time? How competitive is it?
Well, that's where, the biggest problem that solar energy faces today is that people don't realize how widespread it could be deployed cost-effectively. There are millions of homes around the world, in the industrialized world, that could cost-effectively deploy solar if it were properly financed, which is something that most people don't understand. That's why, and so they end up making some inefficient assumptions about how it would be deployed, and I can talk more about that. But there are millions of homes and businesses that could cost effectively deploy solar, but clearly not every home and business could. So many people who want to might not find it cost effective yet.
What does it cost at this point in time, in terms of, per kilowatt hour?
It's going to depend a lot on where you're located and how much sun you get. Really, once you know the cost of the system, it's just the amount of sun that you get that determines what the cost of solar energy is, and then you have to compare that to what it replaces. And if the historical calculations look at the average cost of solar energy, and they compare it to the average cost of a coal-fired power plant, and they see that solar energy is four times as expensive. And so, therefore, they sort of stop and say, "Well, the solar is not cost-effective." And that's the wrong way to think about it for two reasons. One, solar energy is one of those interesting technologies that allows for the energy to be delivered directly at the point of use. It doesn't have to be put into the grid the way coal-fired energy nuclear power has to be put into the grid. It can be delivered directly to the point of use. So solar doesn't compete with coal. It competes with grid electricity, and grid electricity prices in the United States are, you know, anywhere from 6 cents a kilowatt hour to 30 cents a kilowatt hour, depending on where you are and what kind of power you're talking about. The other reason that calculation's not right is that solar provides the most expensive part of the power system. It provides middle of the day, at the highest energy use power. And for a lot of businesses who have time of day pricing and pay for energy based on what time of day it is, solar is wildly cost effective because you then replace the most expensive part of the power infrastructure with solar. So there's a number of things, and then the third way that everybody messes it up is that they use the wrong financing assumptions, and they assume that you have to use a payback period where you pay cash today and you pay off the system in 6 or 7 years. But if you actually wrap it into the cost of the building and the mortgage, and you pay it out over the life of the system, you can and it's cost effective. You can start getting cost savings immediately with no capital outlay.
Yeah. Another part of the issue too is that the calculation is difficult because other energy sources, conventional energy sources, and their delivery are subsidized.
Well, yes. Unfortunately, if you're going to, that's absolutely true. And when you look at the analysis, it's staggering to see how much money is spent subsidizing the existing energy infrastructure, both direct and indirect. But the book is really about the issues of how we make decisions, and the work that we do tries to, you know, assumes that we can't undo some of the things that currently exist. So, unfortunately, solar has to play a role in a world that might not be fair. And so, solar has to become cost effective in the world that we live in, not the world that we should live in or want to live in.
Yeah.
And it still turns out to be true.
Now, the big players on the stage, are they receptive or resistant?
Well, this is another reason why solar has reemerged recently as a viable alternative. First is that it's gotten cheaper over the last 2 or 3 decades. It costs 10% of what it cost in the mid '70s. So you can imagine that something that's 1/10 of its price the last time around is probably getting to somewhere near cost effective in a number of applications, and that's what's happening. But the other thing is that solar's become very big business. It's already a $20 billion a year industry worldwide, just to give you a comparison, I was just reading today a statistic that that this year the entire roofing market in the United States is $15 billion. So the global solar energy industry is bigger than the entire U.S. roofing market, right? Just to give you some kind of comparison, this is big business. There are lots of people doing this around the world, in Germany, Japan, Spain, Portugal. California is a big adopter of solar, and there are, you know, tens of thousands of people that have put solar on hundreds of thousands of homes. And the people that are in the industry now are companies like GE, Sharp, Sanyo, Kyocera, and then a number of dedicated producers in Europe and even in China. One of the top five richest people in China is a man who made his fortune all in the last 3 years, and all from building one of the largest solar energy companies in the world. So there's really big money, really big business behind this now, in a way that it has never happened before.
Yeah, so there's a lot of opportunities out there for entrepreneurs.
There certainly are. On the installation side, absolutely. To get into the manufacturing side for solar energy is increasingly a big money business, and that's where you're seeing a lot of those names that I mentioned. But those big businesses can't do anything about integration and distribution and installation, and so there are a ton of opportunities for people that want to develop that skill set to be able to take the various components and cost effectively deploy those on the customer's sites, help them find appropriate financing, educate the customer about that, come out to your home and tell you what you need. So there is a huge opportunity in the predicted $1 trillion a year worldwide solar energy industry by 2030. There's plenty of money to be made.
Okay, so where are we on the curve at the moment? Where are we? You know, where are we headed?
Well, so solar is still a very small part of the total electricity infrastructure, but this year it's probably going to represent over 1% of the new energy capacity installed this year. Still a very small number, but if you look out at some very reasonable projections by 2020, half the new electricity capacity in the world will be added in that year will be solar based, and then probably half of the remainder will be other forms of renewable and alternative energy. So that's going to be a radically different world, and that's less than 15 years away. So we're in that what they call the steep part of the learning curve, where things are ramping up very quickly. The industry's grown by about 40% per annum for the last 7 years, and the expectations are that growth rates in excess of 25 to 30% per annum over the next decade are not unreasonable. There's a lot of programs that have come online, and the leaders were Japan and Germany, but half a dozen other major countries or states, in the case of California, have come on with similar programs in the last year. And nearly every government of every level, local, subnational, national governments are looking at programs to accelerate the deployment of solar energy. So we're just in the beginning stages of a very fast ramp up over the next 15 years, at the end of which it'll be a radically different world than we see today.
Hmm. Let's go back to the issue of why this makes sense. And you say economically it makes sense, and you say that's going to become even more economically cost effective as we move along.
Sure, I actually refer to it as economically inevitable.
Yeah, but I want to back up and talk a little bit about politically why does it make sense.
Well, there's a lot of benefits that solar brings. So the beyond the economics, well, it's hard to detach everything from economics, especially if you're an economist. But the benefits that solar brings, there's two or three major problems that our current energy infrastructure create. The three major problems is the way I like to think about it. There are environmental problems, and those are air quality based, and really in that the major issues in air quality have to do with the dirtiest fossil fuels or coal, which we use a lot of for our electricity infrastructure, or environmental problems from the waste of nuclear reactors, or there's all kinds of environmental problems that our various sources of energy create. There's also energy security problems, which is that the source of the energy that you need isn't in your control in some sense, and that's everybody understands that to be true in the oil industry, where we import more than half of our oil from overseas. But and that number is increasing. Many of these countries are not stable nor friendly. So we have that issue. But it's actually true in natural gas and some of the other potential energy sources. In a little more subtle way, but the third issue is that the economic risks that our long supply chains for energy create, meaning that the possibility of disruptions anywhere through the supply chain. Hurricane Katrina was a perfect example of this. Is that a hurricane could shut down a major portion of our energy infrastructure, and the economic repercussions of that nearly threw us into a recession afterwards. So the thing about solar is that it deals with all three of those simultaneously, unlike many of the other energy solutions. And so that's why solar really is the one that we should be focusing on. It creates by putting it on at the point of use at the home or business level, what it creates is a very robust infrastructure. It's not all centralized the way our current infrastructure is. It's got energy generation capacity much closer to where it's needed, creating a more robust infrastructure. And the analogy for that would be how we've seen the computer industry transform over the last 20 years from very large centralized mainframes to a system where we have lots of computing power on everyone's desks, in their cars, and in their, in their cell phone.
Yeah, yeah. Also, it seems to me that we could also talk about supply and reliability.
Yeah, there are huge issues related to that, and one is the permanent supply, which is the possibility that we are running out of the resources that we need, and that we will fall off a cliff, if you will, of availability of fuel supplies. But really, the issues are the temporary short-term issues that create huge fluctuations in the prices. I mean, the price of natural gas in the last 18 months has been, gone from $4 to, $15 per 1,000 cubic feet, back down, back up. Oil's gone from, $40 a barrel to, $80 to back down to, in the mid-50s. These are very disruptive, and from an economic standpoint, we don't realize how expensive it is for us to have to deal with that on a day-to-day basis. The thing about solar energy is when you lock in the price of the panel and you put it on your home, that solar energy panel, it's warranted for 25 years to generate electricity at some rate. But the reality is that the solar panels will last 100 years. They'll generate electricity for a long, long, long time, and the marginal cost of that electricity is nearly nothing. So once you make the solar panels, you have no fuel price risks, no supply disruptions, and a guaranteed supply for decades.
Yeah. Well, something also to consider is we hear daily about the growing demand for energy across the world, in particular in respect to demand in China and India. And the International Energy Agency is predicting demand growth for the coming year, 2007, at 1.7%. And at the same time, OPEC is rolling in cuts in production, not, putting out as much.
Sure.
So this is politically, this is a global, worldwide issue.
Yeah, absolutely. The Chinese are the Indian government both realize that they need local sources of energy. This is why Japan and Germany got on board the solar issue very early on, because either of those countries has a particularly large amount of sun. In fact, they're probably some of the worst places from a sunlight standpoint. But they realized that they didn't have access to domestic sources of fuels the way the United States or Australia or some of the other countries do. Even China has a pretty good supply of coal, but nearly no oil. So, and China's been a little bit more progressive even about deploying solar energy technologies. So everyone's beginning to realize that to meet their own demand and to meet their growth in demand in a reasonable, responsible way, they're going to have to develop domestic supplies of electricity. And some places will try nuclear, and some places may try geothermal. Examples of that being Finland and Iceland, respectively. But those are also not countries with a huge amount of sunlight. But the bulk of the world and the bulk of the developing world has amazing solar resources. In fact, most of the poorest people in the world live within the tropical bands in which the solar energy is most constant, and solar is already the most cost-effective source of electricity, and it's being deployed in tens or hundreds of thousands of homes every year. So that's what I mean about some places it will be the only viable solution.
Travis Bradford is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the president and founder of the Prometheus Institute for Sustainable Development. He's also the author of Solar Revolution, the Economic Transformation of the Global Energy Industry. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Charleston on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I wanted to ask your speaker about the life cycle costs that he may have studied of individual solar systems for the at the homeowner level versus the delivered costs using nuclear or say a 1,000 megawatt coal-fired plant versus say wind farms. When you put it all together over say a 30-year period, delivered at the point of use. So that takes into account the transmission costs. Have you made those kinds of evaluations?
Sure. That's the book that Celeste mentioned actually talks in detail about those calculations and collapsing the analysis to be able to compare an on-site delivered technology like solar to the sort of the aggregate centralized delivery system through the grid of the various forms of electricity. The conclusion, not to take these assumptions out of the real world, but the assumption is that the existing energy infrastructure can turn over its portfolio and does turn over its portfolio of generating assets about 2% per annum, and it has a transmission and distribution cost that has to be paid every year. The thing about solar is that because it's put on at the point of use, let me finish the first thought. Because you only turn over about 2% of your generation base every year, and you've got to really the cost of the infrastructure or the cost of the electricity for grid-based electricity is primarily in the cost of the infrastructure. It's very little in the fuel costs. But the average cost for the electricity delivered to the home really can't change all that much. There's a little bit of efficiency gained by better asset management and a little bit less or a little bit more expensive because we need to add additional generation assets. And we've actually underinvested in the transmission and distribution capacity, according to the IEA, over the last 20 years. So, you can sort of think about today's electricity prices from the grid being a good proxy for future electricity prices. But solar is getting cheaper by about 5 to 6% per annum every year. And looking both top-down and bottom-up at that analysis, that's expected to continue for the next couple of decades, which means that while it may only be cost-effective to put solar in about 10% of the homes in America today on the calculation that you suggested, by 2015 it'll be half of what it is today, which opens up a whole lot more applications. Probably a third to a half of the homes in America could be cost-effectively serviced by solar electricity, and by 2025 it's the vast majority.
Well, your point of saying that that would arguably be true, perhaps with building new homes that are being built and adding that kind of capability, you still nonetheless have to have a grid connection during periods of times when the sun isn't shining and you're not generating electricity. So you're always going to have a network issue, I think, or a grid connection issue, don't you think? The other point is that is there anywhere, have you done any cost analysis that would say that for an existing house, say living in East Central Illinois, what would be the break even point, or what would be the capital cost and life cycle cost, say over a 20-year period or 30-year period, so that you have a reasonable financial model there.
Sure, and that's what I said. If you look in the book, all of that is outlined pretty clearly in the book. And yes, I certainly understand that that for a grid-tied system, you need you would need the network, but you would only need it to the point at which the solar plus a backup power solution would still be less costly than solar plus the grid connection to the grid. And right now, the grid connection to the grid is a very small part of your bill. So there are ways in which that this will transform, so that you will either be able to cost effectively do it one way, or you will be able to cost effectively do it another. But the point is, when your generation assets are dropping in half, the cost of your generation for your new energy source is dropping in half every 10 years. The distributed solution gets cost-effective very quickly, even when you take into consideration all of the things that you've suggested, which are all absolutely true.
When you talk about the cost dropping, is that including the installed cost, or is that just the cost of the photovoltaic cells?
It's both.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let's go to another listener, caller in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yes. I'd like to inquire about how well-prepared American universities and architecture schools are with regard to this kind of technology. And I'll take my answer off the phone.
Good question.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic question and really insightful to think through the problem, because what we really do need are an army of designers and engineers to figure out how to do this on, you know, building a distributed architecture. While it has some benefits, it also has some disadvantages, and the inherent problem in a distributed architecture is information and the information about the hows, the wheres, the how much. These are the things that the architects and engineers are going to have to do. And from a teaching curriculum standpoint, today the universities are not well prepared. There is some attempts through some of the industry support organizations, and also through some of the professional organizations, some of the professional architectural organizations, to try to begin to incorporate this into the curriculum. Where the universities are doing a better job is that student-led movements at a number of universities have required that the universities themselves become greener in the way they harness their energy. And there's a number of programs at universities around the country that have made universities completely green. In fact, that they've either reduced the amount of energy that they need, or they have put on on-site generation for solar and, in some cases, wind, and then in final case, whatever they couldn't get there, they bought green tags, which is a way that you can buy certified green power from your utility or a third-party provider. So the universities have actually done a better job, because of student-led movements, in becoming green than teaching how to become green. But that is something that will have to continue to meet the needs of this rapidly growing industry.
Yeah. Well, we've mentioned engineers and architects. There are other players involved in seeing that this could come to fruition. Would you talk further about the things, the people, the sectors of the economy involved in building the infrastructure for this industry?
Sure. Well, I think, as the first caller intuited, at the end of the day, the utilities are going to be a very important part of the whole solution, because the utilities are the ones that you're going to connect to these distributed systems to. And in 37 or 38 states around the country, there's a law that mandates that you be able to connect your solar system to the utility and get some compensation, although in some cases it's more fairly structured than others. Some compensation for the electricity that you're generating that's tied to the grid. So utilities are an important component. And as implied by the notion that you need to be able to finance these systems correctly, you need to be able to roll them into the mortgage of your commercial facility or your building.
Mm-hmm.
Or in some cases, if you're going to do large utility-scale installations, you're going to need large, sophisticated capital markets to be able to put up the hundreds of millions of dollars that it would take to do a large utility-scale installation. Just like if you were building any other kind of centralized power plant, you'd need some kind of project financing for that. So capital markets at all levels, the residential, the commercial, and the industrial scale, are all going to be required to participate in this and spread the payments of these systems out over the life of the systems and over the benefit of the electricity that comes out of them for decades.
Mm.
So those are some of the other ones, and then the engineers, the architects, and the tradesmen and women that will be doing the installations themselves all need to kind of come together to make this happen. But I think the profit motive is motivating them in that direction.
Yeah. And what about at the consumer level? I mean, if it can save me money, that's one motivator. But how else do consumers think about an alternative like this?
Well, that's the thing about I think it's my corollary to Lincoln's message that anybody who doesn't like sausage or politics shouldn't watch either one being made. I think that most people don't like to see their energy being made, even if it's a solar panel on their roof. And they don't like to have to figure it out. They really like the ease of being able to call up somebody and say, hey, I'd like my energy turned on now, thank you, mm-hmm. click, and it's on. And so there are businesses that are arising that will be able to do that for consumers. And it'll happen in one of two ways. One way is for new construction. There's a new million solar roofs bill that's just been passed in California. They want to get solar on a million home equivalents in California. And as part of that, they've mandated that all builders of new homes by 2012 offer solar as an option on a new home. So when you go in and you're specifying the things you'd like on your new home, whether you'd like solar panels put on at the time of construction, which reduces the cost of installation and wraps it into the cost of your mortgage, check here, and you can have solar on your home. That's a nice way to do it for new homes. And in the retrofit market, there are businesses that are arising that can basically come to you and say, we can install solar on your roof. We'll be out here the week of, week after next. We'll put this much solar on your roof. We will give you a financing package, a solar second mortgage, and it's going to cost you, X dollars per month for the life of that system. And that price is less than what you pay for the equivalent amount of electricity that it replaces. So it makes it very simple for the consumer to transact that, and I think that's the way the business models are arising to help the consumers to get what's in their economic interest.
Mm. You mentioned 1 million roofs. This is one of the ways that Japan apparently fostered solar. They had a program called 70,000 roofs.
Yep.
And how did that work out? When was that put in place, and how did that work?
The Japanese, it was also called the Sunshine Program, and the Japanese program is a model for how to help accelerate the deployment of a cost-effective technology that doesn't start out as cost-effective but makes it cost-effective in the end, so that subsidies are no longer necessary. And so what it did, it started in about 1995, and it had a combination of consumer incentives to help bring down the cost of the systems for consumers, good financing to help them get a good financing package to pay for them and spread the payments out over time, and some R&D money for the suppliers to help develop the next generation of technologies. All these things happened simultaneously. There was a good coordinated activity between the government and the corporate sectors. And over 10 years, those subsidies were slowly phased out so that today the Japanese are putting in something like 350 megawatts a year of new solar capacity without any subsidies at all. So that it was a model program, but only because it sort of hit all of the important components and then slowly kind of phased itself out over time, and many other countries have tried to do that. Germany's looked at a similar program, although they've made some changes to how the payments are made. In the U.S., we have pieces of it, but nobody's done it quite as successfully as the Japanese.
Let's take another call. A listener in Cullom, Illinois, on line 4. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I have a relatively new home. It's approximately 20 years old, and it's needing a new roof. And can you tell me where would I go for a good dealer that could steer me in the right direction to put some type of solar heating on the roof?
Well, that's a good question, and one that comes up often. And I'm not sure that there's a universal answer. It still, unfortunately, takes a little bit of work to find the right people, and then to learn all of the components and pieces. There's a couple of sources that you can go to. The Solar Energy Industry Association is based in Washington D.C. and in their membership base, they have many of the installers around the country. But there's also an organization in Illinois. I don't know if the listener or if the caller's from Illinois or not, but the Illinois Solar Energy Association, which is www.illinoisolar.org, is another place that you may be able to get that information. So those are probably your best bets. Go through the trade associations, and they should be able to point you to somebody locally.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Pravis Bradford, author of Solar Revolution, the Economic Transformation of the Global Energy Industry. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Does it make sense for us in this part of the country to look into solar on the rooftop, given that it is often so cloudy here? This week we're looking at cloudy Monday through Friday.
Well, that's a good Illinois may not be the first place that I would think of as the optimal place to put solar. There are a lot sunnier places. Southern California, Nevada, these are pretty good places. And it also depends a little bit on where you're getting your current electricity sources. And if I remember correctly, I think that Illinois still relies a fair amount on the coal deposits, both east and west of Illinois, for its electricity generation. So if the grid electricity prices are low and there's not a lot of sun, it may not be economic today if you just do the cash on cash comparison. I don't think that's a fair comparison, because nobody does a cash on cash comparison of the marble countertops in their kitchen. Mm. I find that to be disingenuous. But I understand that it needs to be close, and so it's probably close, but may not be close enough for some people. But the point about all of this is that if it's not yet cost effective, it's getting cheaper so fast that by the time someone moves into their next home, it's probably something that needs to be considered.
Yeah, let's talk about the technology a little bit, because I think this is very interesting, and you go into it quite a bit in the book Solar Revolution. What kinds of advances have been made in the technology since the 1970s? And we had, I think it was our first caller, mentioned photovoltaic cells.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about what this technology is and how it works, if you can, for us lay folks.
Well, absolutely. It's very interesting. Imagine the let's see, best way to do this. Imagine that the computer chip in your computer, you could take it out and you could hold it up to the sun and it would generate electricity. That's roughly about how it works. It's a semiconductor. It's based on a silicon substrate that, just like a memory chip, and it uses the photons of light that hit it to free up electrons that then can be captured and used to generate electricity, or that is electricity. It's a solid state device. There's no moving parts. There's no fluids. So you just put this this flat piece of electronics that's well encapsulated and covered, and so that it can withstand the elements. But you just put that up, face it toward the sun, and hook up the wires, and it starts to generate electricity. That's why it lasts so long. It lasts 25 years is the manufacturer's warranty. But the same technologies can be used or should expect to last many decades longer than that, generating electricity. So that's the first generation of technology. That technology has been around for 50 years, it was originally developed at Bell Labs. But there's another generation of technologies that's coming along, and those are called thin films. One of the biggest problems with the current set of technologies is the amount of silicon that you have to use, and the purity makes it more expensive than it should be, or it's the bottleneck or the obstacle to continued cost reductions. So there's this new set of technologies that gets away from silicon by basically painting layers of semiconductors onto glass or steel or something, and then using that. And another advantage of those is that they can be put into the building materials. There's many new applications today where the solar's put right into the window or into the roof tile. or in some cases, in the third generation of technologies, can be painted right onto onto a car or a laptop or the side of a house. So there's many different ways that this technology can be used. But they're all based on that same sort of photoelectric principle.
So aesthetically, then, too, this should be improving.
It's absolutely back to my theory that people don't like to see their energy being made.
Yeah.
That's the flip side is that as the technologies improve, they can be hidden more and more. And now they have many roofs that incorporate the technology that you, if you don't know what you're looking for, you wouldn't realize that they were generating electricity.
Hmm. In this part of the country, we've seen a good deal of interest in wind and now biomass.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the future is for these sources of energy?
Well, I think for a lot of this, a lot of the meta economics that are going on, I think that both of those are emerging and rapidly growing, and should be and will be, rapidly growing technologies. But they meet different needs. That, unfortunately, not all energy is the same, and wind generates a certain type of energy that can be used really in large-scale applications. It's not a point-of-use kind of technology.
Mm-hmm.
So it will continue to supplement the existing grid architecture, and it will do so in the capacity that it can, which is either whenever the wind's blowing, or coupled with some backup and storage technologies to make it a little more even and a little more easy to dispatch. Biofuels are very different. Biofuels are used directly for the transportation infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
and what they're going to be able to do is they're going to be able to create a they're essentially a pressure valve on the price and availability of the traditional sources of transportation fuels or oil. So if prices get too high in oil, as they did over the last year, people are going to run out, and they're going to build more biodiesel refineries or ethanol refineries. So it's going to act as a pressure valve on price and volumes needed to maintain our transportation infrastructure. But it can't, even if you make cars radically more efficient. Unfortunately, there aren't enough programs to try to do that, and certainly not enough national leadership to do that. But the even if you make them super efficient, we still don't have enough biodiesel or ethanol to power our fleets or power all of our transportation needs. I don't believe that you ever solve the transportation problem until you use electricity to power at least a portion, which is what today's hybrid cars do and what tomorrow's plug-in hybrids do to a greater degree, is to use electricity to power our electricity infrastructure. But in that case, you have to make sure you're giving the electricity from a clean source and not from a traditional coal-fired power plant.
There are so many trade-offs back and forth, because with biofuels here, this is something that is in our part of the world is very important to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to come up here on the, we're going to talk with, Todd Gleason is going to have the closing market report for us. And we're going to talk about, where prices are for corn and beans. And the price for corn and beans has been on the rise,
mm-hmm.
recently, and it's in fact in part because there's a pressure, are you going to turn these crops into fuel, or are they going to remain food stocks? So,
yep. Well, that is a problem, is that if you use too much of what would otherwise be food stocks for transportation, by competition, you're going to drive up prices. And that may be okay, right? Because it may be that we can solve some of the other problems of foreign sources and volatility of prices by paying a small premium on our corn and beans. But in the end, we're going to have to use electricity to power some portion of our transportation network, and that's exactly why you're seeing these plug-in hybrids emerge. To help bridge that and reconnect these two energy infrastructures. And as you reconnect them all back to having the option of using electricity, your number of options for generating the energy increases as well.
Yeah, I guess it's all about finding the right mix.
Yeah, and frankly, I'd rather be paying a few extra dollars to every time I go to the grocery store Farmers in your part of the country than to people providing oil from overseas. So,
well, I think a cheer just went up for you in a certain segment of our audience this afternoon. Travis Bradford, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Travis Bradford is the founder and director of the president and founder of Prometheus Institute for Sustainable Development. It's on the web at www.prometheusinstitute.org. He's the author of Solar Revolution, The Economic Transformation of the Global Energy Industry. The book is published by the MIT Press.